Hello, this is Elizabeth Ortel, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the September 17th, 2025 issue of the New York Times and the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service from the front page. Israeli ground forces move into Gaza City, sowing chaos. The Israeli military launched a long-threatened ground assault to take over Gaza City after a night of intense bombing, sending many residents fleeing on Tuesday from the devastated but still densely populated urban area that is home to hundreds of thousands of Palestinians. The ground operation and the intensifying bombardment deepened the humanitarian crisis in the Gaza Strip, which has been shattered by a nearly two-year war that has killed tons of thousands of people and caused rampant hunger. Palestinians in Gaza City described scenes of panic as Israel pounded the area with heavy airstrikes that shook the ground. Local health officials said more than 20 people have been killed and dozens more wounded. "We are all terrified," said Montasser Baja, a former school teacher sheltering in an apartment in western Gaza City near the coast. "Death would be more merciful than what we're living through." Israel said the ground operation, which had been building up for weeks, was necessary to free the remaining hostages seized in the Hamas-led 2023 raid that started the war, and to prevent the militants from regrouping and planning future attacks. It announced the operation on the same day that a United States commission investigating the war said that Israel was committing genocide against Palestinians. Israel has vehemently denied the accusation, saying that the target of its military campaign is Hamas, not the Palestinian people. But its latest ground operation fueled more international criticism of its conduct in the war. After stepping up airstrikes in recent days, the Israeli military said on Tuesday that soldiers from three divisions of active duty and reserve troops had begun expanded ground operations in Gaza City. In the coming days, additional troops are expected to gradually advance into the city, an Israeli military official said at a briefing with reporters on Tuesday, asserting that at least 2,000 Hamas militants remained there. An Israeli military spokesman, Brigadier General Effi Defron, said the operation would last as long as necessary to free the hostages and defeat Hamas, estimating that it would take a number of months. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel said the attack was an attempt to decisively rout Hamas in one of its last strongholds, but many Israelis are skeptical. Israel has repeatedly conducted major offenses in parts of Gaza without forcing Hamas to surrender or lay down its weapons. Mr. Netanyahu said in a video statement on Tuesday evening that Israeli forces were operating in Gaza City to defeat Hamas and to hasten the departure of the remaining residents. "We are making efforts at the moment to open additional routes to facilitate a quicker evacuation of the Gaza population and to separate them from those terrorists we want to attack," he said. The Israeli military said 350,000 Gaza City residents had heeded previous evacuation orders, but roughly 500,000 people are believed to still be sheltering in the city, parts of which have been leveled by airstrikes. The Israeli military warned those remaining on Tuesday to leave immediately. Many did, walking along dusty roads next to trucks loaded with mattresses and tents. But others said they simply could not afford to flee. "I don't have anywhere to go in southern Gaza. No house, no tent, no car in which to travel," said Mr. Baja, the former school teacher. "They're not fighting Hamas. They're fighting all of us civilians." It was unclear how far Israeli forces had advanced into the city. Satellite imagery on Tuesday morning showed Israeli armored vehicles on nearly all sides of Gaza City. Israeli military analysts said the troops were expected to move slowly in part out of fear they could accidentally strike hostages. The Israeli military believes that Hamas militants will not fire on the troops as they move into the city, according to two Israeli military officials who spoke anonymously to discuss war planning. Instead, Hamas will likely wait until Israeli forces are deep inside Gaza City and then launch guerrilla-style ambushes, they said. The Israeli government signed off on the plan to take over Gaza City in August, when Israeli forces were operating on the city's outskirts. By the end of the month, much of Gaza City's Zaton neighborhood had been razed to the ground. Since then, Israeli military strikes have destroyed high-rise buildings that the military said Hamas was using for surveillance and other activities. Hamas has denied the claims. The Israeli Defense Minister, Israel Katz, said the military was carrying out the incursion at the most significant test point in the campaign to defeat Hamas. The greater the intensity of the attack here, the more directly it will overwhelm Hamas, he said in a statement. And it will also create greater leverage for the release of the hostages. Hamas condemned the ground operation, saying it would worsen the humanitarian catastrophe engulfing Gaza. In a statement, the militant group called on the international community to intervene against Israel and stop the new offenses, which it accused the United States of enabling. The operation has divided Israelis. While some praised it as is a critical step to vanquish Hamas, others said it would endanger the lives of Israeli soldiers and about the roughly 20 remaining hostages who are believed to be alive. Relatives of the hostages and others demonstrated against the ground assault outside Mr. Netanyahu's house on Monday night. "There is no other place to be," said one of the protesters, Michael Gilad, 53. "But we aren't of interest to this government, nor are the hostages or the soldiers." The operation led to further international condemnation of Israel's military offensive in Gaza. Britain's Foreign Secretary Yvette Cooper called it utterly reckless and appalling. "It will only bring more bloodshed, kill more innocent civilians, and endanger the remaining hostages," Ms. Cooper said in a post on social media, in which she reiterated calls for a ceasefire, for the hostages in Gaza to be released, and for aid to enter the territory without restrictions. Germany, which has been a staunch supporter of Israel, also criticized the assault, with the country's foreign minister saying the country was on the wrong path. "We reject this and have made this clear to the Israeli government," he said at a news conference in Berlin. Also from the front page of the September 17th New York Times, Robert Redford, the big screen charmer turned Oscar-winning director whose hit movies often helped America make sense of itself and who, off-screen, evangelized for environmental causes and fostered the Sundance-centered independent film movement, died early Tuesday morning at his home in Utah. He was 89. His death in the mountains outside Provo was announced in a statement by Cindy Berger, the chief executive of the publicity firm Rogers & Cohen PMK. She said he had died in his sleep, but did not provide a specific cause. "He was in the place he loved, surrounded by those he loved," the statement said. With a distaste for Hollywood's dumbed-down approach to movie making, Mr. Redford typically demanded that his films carry cultural weight, in many cases making serious topics like grief, familial, societal, and political corruption resonate with audiences, in no small part because of his immense star power. Unlike other stars of his caliber, he took risks by exploring dark and challenging material. While some people might only have seen him as a sun-kissed matinee god, his filmography, like his personal life, contained currents of tragedy and sadness. As an actor, his biggest films included Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, 1969, with its loving look at rogues in a dying old West, and All the President's Men, 1976, about the journalistic pursuit of President Richard M. Nixon in the Watergate era. Mr. Redford played Bob Woodward and used his clout in Hollywood to bring the book of the same name by Mr. Woodward and Carl Bernstein to the screen. In 3 Days of the Condor, 1975, Mr. Redford was an introverted CIA analyst caught in a murderous cat-and-mouse game. The Sting, 1973, about Depression-era grifters, gave Mr. Redford his first and only Oscar nomination as an actor. Mr. Redford was one of Hollywood's preferred leads for decades, whether in comedies, dramas, or thrillers. He had range. Studios often sold him as a sex symbol. Although he was a subtle performer with a definite magnetism, his body of work as a romantic leading man owed a great deal to the commanding actresses who were paired with him. Jane Fonda in Barefoot in the Park, 1967, Barbara Streisand in The Way We Were, 1973, Meryl Streep in Out of Africa, 1985. Redford has never been so radiantly glamorous, the critic Pauline Kael wrote in The New Yorker, as when we saw him through Barbara Streisand's infatuated eyes. He branched into directing in his 40s and won an Academy Award for his first effort, Ordinary People, 1980, about an upper middle class family's disintegration after a son's death. A story that reflected the repressed grief and emotional silence in his own family after the death of his mother when he was a teenager. Ordinary People won 3 other Oscars, including for Best Picture. His next film as a director, The Milagro Beanfield War, 1988, a comedic drama about a New Mexican farmer denied water rights by uncaring developers, was a flop. But Mr. Redford stubbornly refused to pursue less esoteric material. Instead, he directed and produced A River Runs Through It, 1992, a spare period drama about Montana fly fishermen pondering existential questions, and Quiz Show, 1994, about a notorious 1950s television scandal. Quiz Show was nominated for 4 Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director. Perhaps Mr. Redford's greatest cultural impact was as a make-it-up-as-he-went independent film impresario. In 1981, he founded the Sundance Institute, a nonprofit dedicated to cultivating fresh cinematic voices. He took over a struggling film festival in Utah in 1984, and renamed it after the Institute a few years later. He had been a local since 1961, having spent some of his early earnings as an actor on 2 acres of land in Provo Canyon. He often said he liked Utah because it gave him a sense of peace and was the antithesis of Hollywood superficiality. The Sundance Film Festival in Park City became a global showcase and freewheeling marketplace for American films made outside the Hollywood system. With heat generated by the discovery of talents like Steven Soderbergh, who unveiled his Sex, Lies, and Videotape at the festival in 1989, Sundance became synonymous with the creative cutting edge. The directors Quentin Tarantino, James Wan, Darren Aronofsky, Nicole Holofcener, David O. Russell, Ryan Coogler, Robert Rodriguez, Chloe Zhao, and Ava DuVernay were nurtured by Sundance early in their careers. Sundance also grew into one of the world's top showcases for documentaries, in particular those focused on progressive topics like reproductive rights, LGBTQ issues, and climate change. Mr. Redford complained bitterly about the commercial whirlwind the festival created as it grew to more than 85,000 attendees in 2025 from a few hundred in the early 1980s. I want the ambush marketers, the vodka brands, and the gift bag people and the Paris Hiltons to go away forever, Ms. Redford told a reporter during the 2012 festival as he trudged in snow boots to a screening, a young assistant behind him struggling to keep up. They have nothing to do with what's going on here. Preferring life on his secluded Utah ranch, Mr. Redford created the image of a reluctant star. His Hollywood career, he insisted with characteristic orneriness, was incidental to his real concerns, one of which was the environment. In many ways, he created the actor as environmentalist archetype that stars like Leonardo DiCaprio and Mark Ruffalo would adopt. Mr. Redford did not like to be called an activist, a label he found too severe. But an activist he was. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. In 1970, he successfully campaigned against a six-lane highway that was proposed in a Utah canyon, where one year he received 8 tickets for speeding, rounding the curves in a Porsche Carrera. For 5 decades, Mr. Redford was a trustee of the Natural Resources Defense Council. In 1976, he used his clout to help block the construction of a coal-fired power plant in Utah that had been championed by business leaders as a crucial source of jobs. His campaign against the plant included a 36-page photo spread in National Geographic magazine featuring himself on horseback on the scenic Kaiparowitz Plateau, where construction was to begin. His efforts sparked a backlash. He was called a liberal carpetbagger, and residents of one Utah town burned him in effigy. Another front page article of the New York Times, September 17th. Social platforms duck blame for inflaming divisions before Charlie Kirk's death. After authorities said Mr. Kirk's suspected shooter had been radicalized online, Meta, Reddit, TikTok, and other platforms have stayed quiet, though not Elon Musk, who owns X. After the conservative activist Charlie Kirk was fatally shot at a university rally in Utah last week, Spencer Cox, the state's Republican governor, called social media companies a cancer. Senator Chris Coons, a Democrat of Delaware, blamed the internet for driving extremism in our country. President Trump, who helped found the Truth Social platform, also pointed fingers at social media on Monday and said the accused gunman had become radicalized on the internet. The response from social media companies? Most major platforms have stayed quiet and ducked the spotlight. There has been only one notable exception, Elon Musk, the billionaire owner of the social media site X, who has spread divisive content about Mr. Kirk's assassination by blaming the left and calling for retribution against those who criticized the right-wing activist or celebrated his death. Their reactions are starkly different from a decade ago, when executives at Google, Facebook, Twitter, and other sites repeatedly vowed to work together to limit hate speech, remove violent content, and root out disinformation from their platforms. The aftermath of Mr. Kirk's killing shows how inflammatory and hateful online content has become so intractable that social media companies are no longer promising to solve it. We have regressed, said Graham Brookey, the senior director of the Atlantic Council's Digital Forensic Research Labs, which studies online speech. We are in a worse place now than when countries and companies came together to say never again to violence and hate speech online. For years, social media companies pledged to cleanse their sites of toxic content. In 2018, Mark Zuckerberg, the founder of Facebook, said he planned to hire 10,000 people to work on safety and security issues after the social network was blasted for allowing election interference on its platforms. Twitter and Google's YouTube formed similar safety teams. And at a 2022 White House summit to address hate and extremism, tech companies promised to expand their policies to handle the noxious content. But in the years since, misinformation and toxic speech have remained unrestrained online. After many of the platform's restrictions were criticized as censorship, some began disbanding their teams that worked on trust and safety and left international forums dedicated to taking action against violent content. In January, Meta, the parent company of Facebook, said it was ending its long-time fact-checking program, which had been instituted to curtail the spread of misinformation on its apps. Immediately after Mr. Kirk was killed last week, the issue of violent online content resurfaced as videos of the assassination spread rapidly. Many videos were graphic, with high-resolution footage captured by audience member at Mr. Kirk's rally that showed him being shot and collapsing. Within hours, the videos jumped from X to other platforms like Instagram and YouTube, gaining millions of views. Criticism of tech platforms deepened after details emerged about the life of Tyler Robinson, whom the authorities have identified as the gunman, and who was described by his friends as terminally online. Mr. Robinson was a gamer who took part in online communities and participated in chats on the messaging system Discord. The authorities have suggested that Mr. Robinson fell down internet rabbit holes, allegedly leading him to assassinate Mr. Kirk. Social media companies, which have algorithms that serve more content that a user might be interested in to keep them engaged, have not provided new answers or solutions for how to stop people from being influenced online. In response to Mr. Kirk's shooting, the companies have emphasized that they have rules for dealing with hate speech, violent groups, and extremism. Meta, Google, TikTok, Snap, Reddit, and others said they were all either labeling videos of Mr. Kirk's shooting as sensitive, removing the content, or curbing its spread. Discord and X did not respond to requests for comment. Social media experts said that violent videos can beget more violence, so the removal or labeling of the material was important. Yet many videos of Mr. Kirk's shooting remain online with no warnings. On X on Monday, unlabeled posts showing the video continued proliferating on the platform, according to a New York Times review. The company said last week that users can disable sensitive media on their accounts to prevent violent content from being shown on their feeds. Many lawmakers said what the tech companies have done was not enough. While Mr. Trump and conservative lawmakers previously pushed back against what they saw as censorship by social media companies, some have called in recent days for the platforms to suppress negative posts about Mr. Kirk. Representative Clay Higgins, a Republican of Louisiana, said last week that tech companies should ban every post or commenter that belittled the assassination of Charlie Kirk from all platforms ever. Mr. Musk, who bought Twitter in 2022 and renamed it X, has steadfastly ignored the criticism. The billionaire, who supports free speech and is the most followed person on X, has instead called for the punishment of those who criticized Mr. Kirk. In one post, Mr. Musk singled out Satya Nadella, the chief executive of Microsoft, urging him to take action against Microsoft employees who had made critical public comments about Mr. Kirk. Unity is impossible with evil fanatics who celebrate murder, Mr. Musk wrote in an X post on Monday, referring to Vice President J.D. Vance's speech about radical leftists who had criticized Mr. Kirk. Mr. Musk also shared posts that tried drawing connections between Mr. Robinson and the transgender community, after it was revealed that the suspect lived with a roommate who was transgender. In one post, Mr. Musk referred to the transgender community as a terrorist cell. Mr. Kirk's death has fueled X's popularity. After the shooting videos circulated on the platform last week, and users expressed their emotions about the assassination, people flocked to download the app. On Friday, Nikita Beer, X's head of product, posted that on both Wednesday and Thursday, X had more first-time downloads in the United States than on any single day in its history, including during Twitter. Mr. Brookie said that as long as X allows violent content and hate speech, it was unlikely that other companies could stem such material. Content is collective across platforms, he said. If even one of them permits toxic content, it will virally spread to other platforms. State terrorism charges against Luigi Mangione are dismissed. The judge overseeing the case against Mr. Mangione said the evidence underpinning two of the most serious counts, one of which charged him with first-degree murder, was legally insufficient. New York State terrorism charges against Luigi Mangione, the defendant in the fatal shooting of United Healthcare's chief executive last year, were dismissed on Tuesday, including a first-degree murder count that could have landed him in prison for the rest of his life. The judge overseeing the case, Gregory Caro, said he had found the evidence behind the charges legally insufficient. Mr. Mangione, 27, also faces federal charges and is still charged in New York with second-degree murder, for which he faces a sentence of 25 years to life, among nine other counts. Those cases will proceed, though no trial dates have been set. In charging Mr. Mangione with terrorism, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office seemed to acknowledge the seismic effect of a shooting that sent shockwaves through American society and set off a groundswell of support for a defendant protesting the nation's healthcare system. But the judge's decision means that while Mr. Mangione may ultimately be proved a murderer, New York's legal system will have nothing to say about the broader implications of his actions. The decision by Justice Caro is a blow to the district attorney, Alvin L. Bragg. Mr. Bragg had argued that a terrorism charge was warranted because Mr. Mangione had targeted the chief executive, Brian Thompson, in the media capital of the world, Midtown Manhattan, at the beginning of a busy morning, hoping to create a spectacle that would help further his message. Mr. Bragg described the act as a frightening, well-planned, targeted murder that was intended to cause shock and attention and intimidation. Mr. Mangione's lawyers, led by a former prosecutor, Karen Friedman Agnifilo, had argued that the district attorney's office expanded New York's terrorism statute well beyond its legislative intent and its natural and legal definition. applying the statute in Mr. Van Jones' case would trivialize and redefine the definition of terrorism, they said. New York law requires that prosecutors who charge a defendant with terrorism show that the person attempted to intimidate a civilian population or influence government policy or conduct. Justice Caro said that prosecutors had failed to show that Mr. Van Jones sought to do either. In a statement, a spokeswoman for Mr. Bragg's office, Danielle Filson, signaled that the office would not appeal. We respect the court's decision and will proceed on the remaining 9 counts, including murder in the second degree, she said. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. James M. McGuire, a former prosecutor in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, who also served as an appellate court judge, said on Tuesday that bringing the terrorism charges had been an overreach by the prosecutors. Mr. McGuire said the judge's order was strongly and thoroughly reasoned. It would not be reversed if the DA's office appealed, he said. The next court hearing is scheduled for December 1st, days before Mr. Van Jones is also due in federal court. The shooting of Mr. Thompson in December was one of a flurry of high-profile acts of violence that have swept through American public life in recent years. President Trump faced 2 assassination attempts during last year's campaign, and a Democratic state legislator from Minnesota, Melissa Hortman, and her husband were killed in their home in June. The judge's decision to drop some of the charges against Mr. Van Jones landed amid the tense national conversation that has followed last week's fatal shooting of Charlie Kirk, a prominent conservative activist, and increasing concern about lone gunmen apparently motivated by their internet consumption. Mr. Van Jones, with his many supporters and immediate internet fame, quickly became a symbol of that vigilante mentality, even as he pleaded not guilty. After Mr. Thompson's killing, a manhunt stretched across states, and Mr. Van Jones' arrest caught the attention of the nation. His case galvanized anger at America's largely private healthcare system, and his appearances in court have attracted hundreds of supporters, some lining the hallways and others protesting outside. He has been inundated with correspondents in the federal jail in Brooklyn where he is being held, and his lawyers have created a website to provide information about his case, an online fundraising page set up to benefit his legal defense, listed donations totaling about $1.5 million as of Tuesday. Support for Mr. Van Jones was evident inside the courtroom on Tuesday. One spectator wore a shirt from a Brooklyn pizza spot called Luigi's. Another, a shirt that said, "Free Luigi." Mr. Van Jones is facing prosecution in 2 states and in 3 courts. The federal charges against him include an accusation for which prosecutors have said they plan to seek the death penalty. He also faces charges in Pennsylvania, where he was caught. While some states define first-degree murder as a premeditated killing, New York requires an additional aggravating circumstance, one of which is terrorism. Others include torture and killing a witness or law officer. Prosecutors also charge Ms. Van Jones with a second-degree murder in furtherance of terrorism, one of the counts that was dropped, and another count of second-degree murder. He faces weapons charges as well. If Mr. Van Jones had been convicted on the highest state charges, he would have faced a sentence of life in prison without parole. Terrorism is a fraught term in the legal contest. Prosecutors have used the state's terrorism laws infrequently, and judges have been skeptical when they have been applied. While the prosecutors based several arguments about terroristic intent on Mr. Manjones' writings, Justice Caro said that Mr. Manjones' words seemed to belie those arguments. Mr. Manjones himself explained that his goal was to spread a message and win public support about everything wrong with our health system, a goal that Justice Caro found fell outside the bounds of what the law required. Mr. Manjones even contrasted himself with Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, who he said was a terrorist, the worst person can be. Justice Carroll acknowledged that Mr. Manjones' own characterization of his conduct did not necessarily settle the issue, but wrote, "Where there is no other evidence of terroristic intent, the writings fail to supply that evidence." Mr. Thompson, 50, was walking into a Hilton hotel on West 54th Street to prepare a United Healthcare Investors Day gathering on December 4th, when he was shot and killed. Prosecutors said Mr. Manjones had arrived outside the hotel about an hour earlier and had waited until Mr. Thompson walked to the hotel's entrance. Mr. Manjones then approached the executive from behind, raised a 3D printed 9mm handgun fitted with a suppressor, and shot him, prosecutors said. The police launched a citywide manhunt for the gunman, who fled on what they said was an electric bicycle. Investigators released surveillance pictures of the suspect, including one of him smiling, taken at the front desk of a hostel on the Upper West Side where the police said he had stayed. The authorities also traced the gunman as he moved from the scene of the killing to a bus terminal and then to the 190th Street station in Washington Heights, where the police said he took an A train downtown to Pennsylvania Station. Days later, he was arrested at a McDonald's in Altoona, Pennsylvania, while eating hash browns and looking at his laptop. A fellow customer remarked to a friend that Mr. Manjones resembled the person in photos the police had released. An employee who overheard called the police. The police said Mr. Manjones had been found with a handgun, ammunition, fake identification cards, and what they said was a 262-word handwritten manifesto in which he appeared to take responsibility for the killing. New York's terrorism laws were passed in the days after September 11, 2001, as the nation reeled from the worst such attacks in its history. The first person convicted under the laws was Edgar Morales, a gang member charged in the 2002 shooting that killed a 10-year-old girl. In 2012, the State Court of Appeals overturned that conviction, saying gang activity was not an act of terror. More recently, Abdullah El Faisal, a Jamaican-born cleric, was convicted in Manhattan last year of supporting terrorism after prosecutors portrayed him as a jihadist who had supported ISIS. And in Buffalo, Peyton Gendron, a white man who killed 10 black people in a racist massacre at a supermarket in May 2022, became the first person in the state to be convicted of domestic terrorism motivated by hate, which carries a penalty of life imprisonment without parole. Mr. Manjones has now avoided a similar fate. His supporters had gathered outside the courthouse for days before Tuesday's hearing, some sleeping in tents, and dozens were amassed outside by the time the hearing began. When they heard of the judge's decision, they let out a cheer. Trump leaves a tense America for a brief UK royal retreat. President Trump's trip to Britain will involve horse-drawn carriages and a stay in an ancient castle. For British officials, the visit may feel less like a fairy tale. When President Trump begins a state visit to Britain on Wednesday, it may feel like a holiday from history. For a few days, he will trade the United States and its sulfurous politics for a fairy tale world of horse-drawn carriages, royal artillery salutes, and an opulent banquet in Windsor Castle. Mr. Trump leaves behind a country convulsed by the killing of his ally, the right-wing activist Charlie Kirk, and a White House unable to settle foreign conflicts in Ukraine and Gaza. Britain hopes to use its gilded charms to nudge its guests in the preferred direction on a complex agenda, including transatlantic security and trade. But it is far from clear that Mr. Trump will be interested in more than the pomp and pageantry. And his host, King Charles III, and Prime Minister Keir Starmer may not feel as shielded from the backwash of a messy world. Last week, Mr. Starmer was forced to dismiss Britain's ambassador to the United States, Peter Mandelson, over troubling revelations about his long-ago friendship with Jeffrey Epstein, the financier and convicted sex offender, and the same man whose ties to Mr. Trump have generated their own battery of questions. While Mr. Trump has largely deflected those questions, the Epstein scandal still haunts the British royal family. Charles's younger brother, Prince Andrew, was forced into internal exile in 2019 and later stripped of his military titles after he fumbled questions about his friendship with Mr. Epstein. British officials are determined not to let the sordid saga spoil the visit. They played down Mr. Mandelson's abrupt departure, saying that a British-American technology agreement he negotiated with the Trump administration, billed as the policy capstone of the visit, was signed and sealed. Mr. Mandelson said that he reviewed the technology partnership with Mr. Trump in an Oval Office meeting last Tuesday. Prince Andrew is not expected to take part in the ceremonies involving Mr. Trump and the royal family. Buckingham Palace, instead, plans to feature the king's eldest son, Prince William, and his wife, Catherine, Princess of Wales, who will play host to Mr. Trump's wife, Melania, at a meeting with young scouts. Yet diplomats on both sides of the Atlantic said that the lingering questions were bound to sound a discordant note amid the visit's choreographed rituals. Mr. Trump's trip, after all, is all about symbolism. An imperial-minded president who relishes his ties to the royal family, being feted by an actual king. For him, this is personal, said Fiona Hill, a British-born foreign policy expert who served in Mr. Trump's first term and was involved in planning his earlier trips to Britain. He's building his own dynasty. He wanted to forge those ties with the royal family because that's how he sees his own family. Given the crisis with Mandelson, Ms. Hill added, there are going to be shadows around this trip. Mr. Trump is the only elected leader to be accorded a second British state visit. Queen Margaret of Denmark and King Olaf of Norway each had two. When Mr. Starmer handed Mr. Trump an invitation from the king during an Oval Office meeting in February, he emphasized its extraordinary nature. This is really special, the Prime Minister told the assembled corps. This has never happened before. This is unprecedented. Much has been made of the royal family as a not-so-secret weapon for the British government in its cultivation of Mr. Trump. During the first state visit, the Foreign Office paired off the president with Charles, who was then the Prince of Wales, even though Queen Elizabeth II, then 94, was the official host. The two men were almost contemporaries. Mr. Trump is 79, and they both know a bit about being heirs to a family business. They both also have strong views on architecture, with a preference for a classical style. Charles is overseeing a decade-long refurbishment of Buckingham Palace. Mr. Trump is breaking ground on a ballroom attached to the east wing of the White House. During the first visit, British officials hoped that Charles, a fervent campaigner against climate change, would gently raise the issue with Mr. Trump during a lunch at his London residence, Clarence House. Mr. Trump had announced plans to pull out of the Paris Climate Accord 2 years earlier. Afterward, Mr. Trump told aides that Charles had spoken almost exclusively about climate change, according to an official briefed on the lunch who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss a private meeting. But the president did not express any noticeable irritation, the official said, suggesting that he had a level tolerance for Charles's views because he was heir to the throne. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The king is actually a very accomplished diplomat, said Kim Darroch, who served as ambassador to Washington during Mr. Trump's first term. Charles would tell you what he thought, and he does have some quite strong views. Since Charles ascended to the throne in 2022 after the death of Elizabeth, he has somewhat modulated his commentary on climate change, in keeping with the monarch's traditional obligation to steer clear of politics. But he has not hesitated to exert the monarchy's soft power in some symbolic ways. Charles invited President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine for tea at his country residence, Sandringham, in March, 2 days after Mr. Zelensky was dressed down in the Oval Office by Mr. Trump. In May, he presided over the opening of Parliament in Canada, of which he is head of state, a subtle rebuke to Mr. Trump, who has called for Canada to become the 51st American state. Britain has felt the reverberations of events in the United States. A rally organized by the far-right leader Tommy Robinson on Sunday drew tens of thousands of people into the streets of London. Some said they were honoring Mr. Kirk. Diplomats predicted that the king would not bring up such topics with Mr. Trump. There will be plenty of distractions. A royal salute will be fired from the east lawn of Windsor Castle as Mr. Trump arrives on Monday morning. Charles and his wife, Queen Camilla, will join the Trumps in a carriage procession on the Windsor estate. Mr. Trump and the king will then inspect an honor guard. The president famously stepped in front of Elizabeth at a similar ceremony at Buckingham Palace, which was portrayed at the time as a faux pas, although palace officials later told British diplomats that Mr. Trump had done nothing wrong. A lunch, a wreath laying at the tomb of Elizabeth, and the banquet will follow, all within the crenellated walls of Windsor. That guarantees that Mr. Trump will not face any protesters. In a nod to his fondness for military displays, the king will treat him to a flyover of F-35 fighter jets and Red Arrow acrobatic planes, weather permitting. British officials hope the stagecraft will reduce the risk of unwelcome topics like Mr. Epstein intruding on the visit. Buckingham Palace will do its part by banishing Prince Andrew, who accompanied Mr. Trump on a tour of a Westminster Abbey during his first state visit. But the hosts are well aware of Mr. Trump's penchant for taking questions from reporters and for offering unfiltered responses. The last time Mr. Trump visited London in 2019 for a NATO summit, he was asked about the furor over Andrew's ties to Mr. Epstein. "It's a tough story," the president said. "It's a very tough story." Park Service is ordered to take down some materials on slavery and tribes. The Trump administration ordered a famous Civil War era war image removed from a National Park Service site in Georgia as it moves to promote what it considers a more positive view of American history. The Trump administration has ordered several National Park Service sites to take down materials related to slavery and Native Americans, including an 1863 photograph of a formerly enslaved man with scars on his back that became one of the most powerful images of the Civil War era. The moves by the administration were outlined in internal emails reviewed by the New York Times and two people briefed on the matter who spoke on the condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to comment publicly. The directives stemmed from President Trump's executive order in March that instructed the Park Service to remove or cover up materials that inappropriately disparage Americans, part of a broader effort by Mr. Trump to promote a more positive view of the nation's history. Critics say the effort could lead to the erasure of the contributions of people of color, gay and transgender people, women, and other marginalized groups. At Fort Pulaski National Monument in Georgia, Trump officials have directed Park Service staff to remove a reproduction of the Scourge Back, the famous photo that depicts the formerly enslaved man who was known as both Peter and Gordon, exposing severe scars on his back from whippings, according to the emails and one of the people briefed on the matter. The Washington Post first reported on the directive to remove the photo. Elizabeth Peace, a spokesperson for the Interior Department, the parent agency of the Park Service, said in an email that all interpretive signage in national parks is under review. She accused media outlets of spreading false claims and misinformation about the review, although she did not specify what information was incorrect. At Manassas National Battlefield Park in Virginia, Trump officials have instructed park employees to take down a sign that criticizes the post-Civil War Lost Cause ideology, which romanticized the Confederacy and denied slavery's central role in the conflict. The sign at Manassas, the site of two major Southern victories during the Civil War, was erected last year during the Biden administration. It describes the 1940 dedication of a monument to Thomas Jonathan Jackson, a Confederate general who earned the name Stonewall during the First Battle of Manassas in 1861. The dedication ceremony perpetuated Lost Cause mythology, however, emphasizing Confederate valor and ignoring slavery as the central cause of the Civil War, the sign says. At Independence National Historical Park in Philadelphia, officials plan to substantially alter an exhibit that memorializes nine people enslaved by George Washington. Mr. Trump's executive order in March specifically flagged exhibits at Independence National Historical Park for review, claiming the Biden administration had advanced corrosive ideology that taught visitors that America is purportedly racist. And at Arlington House in Virginia, the former home of Robert E. Lee, who led the Army of Northern Virginia on the Confederate side, Trump officials have instructed park staff to stop using a booklet that was designed to teach children about slavery, said Stephen Hammond, a descendant of people who were enslaved at the house. Trump officials determined that two sentences in the booklet, which has been given to children participating in the Park Service's Junior Ranger program, ran afoul of the president's executive order, Mr. Hammond said. In 1829, Robert E. Lee promised to serve the Army and protect the United States, the sentences say. In 1861, he broke his promise and fought for slavery. During the Biden administration, the Park Service asked descendants of enslaved people at Arlington House, as well as descendants of Mr. Lee, to help tell a more complete story to visitors of all ages. We think that this space could be used as a place for conversation, healing, and repair, Mr. Hammond said. So to have this booklet targeted is really a disappointment for us. Stephanie McCurry, a professor of history at Columbia University, who studies the Civil War and the Reconstruction era, said it was impossible to separate slavery from the history of these sites. There is no history of the U.S. without slavery in it, Dr. McCurry wrote in an email. It is impossible to edit it out or bury its horrors. The evidence is everywhere and can't be destroyed, certainly not in one presidential administration. As several other national parks, the Trump administration has ordered the removal of signs and other materials that state that the land once belonged to Native American tribes, according to one of the people briefed on the matter. Tribes were forcibly removed from lands across the American West that later became national parks. For instance, the U.S. military forced the Shoshone, Bannock, and other tribes from what is now Yellowstone National Park in Wyoming, Idaho, and Montana. The National Gallery of Art in Washington houses the original version, the Scourged Back, also known as Whipped Peter. Reproductions of the photo appear at Fort Pulaski, where the Union Army successfully tested rifled cannons in 1862, as well as other Park Service sites with connections to the Civil War. The photo was widely circulated in the 19th century, providing a shocking image of the brutality of slavery that helped fuel support for the abolitionist movement among white Northerners. It was widely shared again in 2020, when Black Lives Matter protests surged globally following the murder of George Floyd by the Minneapolis police. The Scourged Back photograph shocked the nation and the world with its honest depiction of the vicious nature of slavery. The decision to remove this photograph from the interpretive displays at national parks is as shameful as it is wrong. Mr. Trump's executive order directed Park Service employees to flag materials by mid-July that could be changed or deleted. It said the administration would begin removing all inappropriate content starting Wednesday, September 17th. The executive order also took aim at the Smithsonian Institution, saying it had come under the influence of a divisive, race-centered ideology. The administration has given the Smithsonian's museums until December to adjust any content that it finds problematic in tone, historical framing, and alignment with American ideals. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the September 17th issue of the New York Times. Your reader has been Elizabeth Ortel. Thank you for listening.